Let's continue our look at the book of Isaiah, in fact, the finishing of the book of Isaiah today, by turning to chapter 66, verse number 15. Now, we were in the context of the second coming of Jesus and how he is bringing both redemption for the saved and judgment for the unsaved. And that context does continue through these last few verses of the book. But we've also got some things that are phrased in the contextual language of Isaiah's day and of Isaiah's culture. And it's because people reading this book, Israelis reading this book from Isaiah's day forward to the first coming of the Messiah, they needed to understand that God wanted them to make the right choice, to be on the right side of the equation. That is, not to be idolaters seeking other gods and goddesses, but rather seeking first he who is and his kingdom. Okay, so with that thought in mind, let's pick up Isaiah 66, verse 15. For behold, he who is will come in fire. And of course, there's several passages in the New Testament, particularly, that picture Jesus coming in flaming fire. And of course, fire speaks of judgment very, very often in the New Testament, and old for that matter. His chariots like the whirlwind. And that's reminiscent of both Elijah and Elisha, where the angels of God, the army, the angelic army of God, are connected with God's chariots, and how they come to claim the righteous. I mean, that's the whole story with Isaiah, with Elijah, isn't it? He's caught away in a whirlwind with the attendants of God's chariots. But they also bring judgment against the unrighteous. To render his anger in fury and his rebuke with flames of fire. For by fire will he who is enter into judgment, and by his sword with all flesh, and those slain by the sword, by he who is shall be many. So we're talking clearly here about the coming judgment of God. And we've got many times throughout Israel's history where God's judgment falls upon the unrighteous people that lay claim to that name. One's already happened in northern Israel, where the entire nation was taken away in judgment by the Assyrians, and a lot of people died. Another one's coming up soon after Isaiah, where the Babylonians will be used by God for that purpose. Another judgment takes place in connection with the Maccabees, and it's predicted in the book of Daniel. That's in the 2nd century BC. It's the origin point for the holiday, the Jewish holiday we just finished not too long ago, Hanukkah. And then there is the judgment that comes after the Messiah is rejected and executed. And even though he resurrected again and his death becomes the source of salvation for those that believe, judgment falls upon the nation again in AD 70. And the city's destroyed, the temple's destroyed, and the ethnic Israelis, many of them die, and the rest are scattered to the four winds. Well, all of that ultimately points toward the judgment that comes at the second coming of Jesus, and that's the day of he who is. Verse number 17 now. Those who sanctify and purify themselves to go into the gardens, following one in the midst, eating pig's flesh and the abomination and mice, shall come to an end together, declares he who is. Now, we saw a little bit of that mentioned earlier in this chapter, yesterday. And that is, some of the Jewish people will be engaging in false worship, bad worship, and it will be counted against them as if they'd gone the full into full-fledged paganism, like is described here. And actually, the truth is, by the time 587, the destruction of Jerusalem, happens after Isaiah, they will be engaging in these sorts of abominable practices openly. That will be in the time of Jeremiah the prophet, who will weep and lament over the actions bringing God's judgment at that time. Verse number 18, "For I know their works and their thoughts." So God knows the inside of everyone. "And the time is coming to gather all nations and tongues. And they shall come, and they shall see my glory, and I will set a sign among them. And from them I will send survivors to the nations, to Tarshish," which generally we think of Spain as being connected to Tarshish as a place, "Pul and Lud," that seems to be on the north coast of Africa, "who draw the bow to Tubal and Javan." Tubal, think right around Armenia in that area to the north of Israel. Tbilisi seems to be connected to the same consonants that Tubal is here. Javan is the ancient name for the area of Greece and Macedonia and up into Albania and places like that. So we're talking about all the places that are to the north and wrapping around the Mediterranean from Israel, and to the south and wrapping around the Mediterranean from Israel. So all these people to the coastlands afar off that have not heard my fame or seen my glory, and they shall declare my glory among the nations. So here's the thing that happens historically. The Jewish people are scattered at the time of the Assyrian exile and the Babylonian exile, and then eventually everything that happens after AD 70. And Jewish pockets of communities get established all over the Mediterranean basin and beyond. And when Jesus comes in fulfillment of all the prophecies of old, and he dies and he rises again, the gospel begins to be preached first in those Jewish communities. You know that Paul kind of adopted this practice. Everywhere he went, he first went to the Jewish community of the synagogue or to the prayer site if it didn't have a synagogue. And he preached to those who already had the prophecies in their mind. And then from there, it exploded to the Gentiles around. And this is how the gospel spread around the world. Well, it's going to now be time to gather back to the promised land. So verse number 20, "They shall bring all your brothers from all the nations as an offering to he who is, on horses and in chariots and in litters and on mules and on dromedaries to my holy mountain Jerusalem, says he who is, just as the Israelis bring their grain offerings in a clean vessel to the house of he who is. And some of them also I will take for priests and for Levites, says he who is." There's probably multiple levels of the prophecy here, and we've seen that not just in Isaiah, but other prophecies of the Old Testament. But we know that the Israelis are eventually gathered back, a large portion of them, back to the promised land, and they become the core of the nation to which the Messiah came the first time. And then, as I said, the gospel explodes outward from there and gets into the Gentile world as well. But we all know the history that has happened in the last century, the century just passed. And that is great trouble and strife and distress during World War I and World War II, and eventually Israelis, ethnic Israelis, start being drawn back to the promised land again. And guess what? A lot of the ethnic nations start helping them return. And a lot of Christians help them return. Now they're trying to evangelize them at the same time and encourage messianic faith in Yahushua, Jesus, he who is salvation. But we end up with the geography of the promised land now being full of ethnic Israelis once more. And I think what we're seeing happen is it sets the stage for the final event. And that is the day of the Lord, the final 3.5 years described in the book of Daniel, but also described in detail in the book of Revelation, that culminates with the second coming of Jesus. And so I think a lot of that is that return to the nation of Israel, that is the site of Israel by ethnic Israelis. I think that's kind of prophesied in here. And in the midst of all that, we do end up with verse 21 saying that some of the ethnic groups, that is the Gentiles, end up becoming priests and Levites of he who is. And New Testament kind of describes believers, Christians, whether they're Jew or Gentile, as priests of God. And so we have kind of seen that fulfilled as well. And then the last part here all seems to be tied in with the millennial period and afterward. It says, verse 22, "For as the new heavens and new earth that I make shall remain before me, says he who is, so shall your offspring and your name remain." So the promise was made, and it's been made in lots of different ways at different times, that there will always be ethnic Israelis. Always. They are never going to be annihilated. It's been tried multiple times. The most recent time was Hitler's attempt at a final solution. But God's never going to let that happen. And so God makes this promise that your offspring and your name is always going to be in front of me. Verse 23, from new moon to new moon. That's a Jewish phrase for meaning from month to month. And from Sabbath to Sabbath, which is a Jewish phrase that means from week to week. All flesh shall come to worship before me, declares he who is. And so when Jesus comes as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, throughout the time of the millennium, and then throughout the time of eternity that follows the millennium, as time rolls forward into eternity, month by month, week by week, year by year, millennium by millennium, we will come and worship before he who is salvation, before he who is the Father, and before he who is the Son. And verse number 24, though, is kind of a rough way to end, but sometimes there needs to be a negative reminder, especially when this book is intended for people still living in a time when choices must be made. So verse 24, "And they shall go out and look on the dead bodies of the men who have rebelled against me. For their worm shall not die, their fire shall not be quenched, and they shall be an abhorrence to all flesh." Now, those last few phrases you will find in the words of Jesus in the Gospels, and you will find them in the book of Revelation as well. And in both contexts, it's about hell. It's about the pit, the lake of unquenchable fire, the place that was made for the devil and his angels, but will also be used for all the rebellious humans. And there's this contrast between the righteous, eternal saints that are worshiping God, and the book of Zechariah pictures this as well, coming to him at Jerusalem, later New Jerusalem, and offering their loyalty, their allegiance. And then this place elsewhere, where the final battle takes place, and I think we're talking about the Battle of Gog Magog, which takes place on the far side of what we call the Dead Sea, probably down somewhere to the south, east of there, in what used to be ancient Edom, and which in other books that we've looked at is described as being a place that has rivers of sulfur and brimstone that flow. And it's kind of a picture of hell. That there's always going to be this permanent reminder to us that the penalty was assessed against those who were the rebels, against the one who was, is, and will always be. Now, how will we feel about that? And I'm always asked this question, you know, especially by people who are worried about their friends and family members that are rejecting the gospel or have already rejected the gospel and died. They feel for them. They weep over them. How is it that they could be happy in eternity knowing that their loved ones came under the judgment of God? And I only have one possible answer for that, and that is, by then we will be perfect in our knowledge and understanding. We will be perfect in our sense of justice and resolution. And therefore, we will acknowledge for all of eternity that God gave the chance, the free will choice to everyone to join him in blessing forever. And those that chose not to did so of their own free will. And that's on them. Now, I know that is hard for us now because we have this finite understanding of everything that's involved in the situation. But I promise you, in eternity, that will be taken care of, and you will not weep and mourn for eternity for those that are not there with you in the presence of God. Kind of a somber note to end this book on, but it's a book that's full of somber things, and I think the best thing we can do is take that to heart and do what we can to share the gospel by word and deed with as many of our loved ones and our acquaintances as we possibly can. Let's turn back to a historical section for just a little bit. I want you to go to 2 Chronicles 32:26. 2 Chronicles 32:26. We know that Isaiah was prophesying during the time of King Hezekiah. In fact, that's the last king listed in the introduction to his book that he prophesied during. And so Hezekiah was the greatest, according to Scripture, of all the kings of Judah. He was a revivalist king. He was a king that cleaned out the temple from all of the abominations of his own father. And he did away with all the idols and the idol worship that was going on during his father's reign and going on behind the scenes during his early reign. And he led the people in a recommitment to God. So he is a good and godly man. Yes, he did make a mistake when he showed his treasuries to those emissaries from Babylon, and that's fully acknowledged, that was a component of his pride. But the overarching character of this man is righteousness. And because of that, God sends peace and prosperity upon his kingdom. And that is described in this section of 2 Chronicles 32:27. Hezekiah had very great riches and honor, and he made for himself treasuries for silver, for gold, for precious stones, for spices, for shields, and for all kinds of costly vessels. So he is not just simply prosperous, he's got more than enough. And so they're storing it away for the use of future generations. Verse 28, storehouses also for the yield of grain, wine, and oil. And we talked about that the last time we were talking about Hezekiah, is that when he renewed the covenant of Israel with God, he also renewed the covenant of Israel with the priests and the Levites, and made sure that the full tithe was being brought in to the storehouses at Jerusalem and the storehouses at all the different communities where the Levites lived around the nation. And so that's all being filled up to overflowing. And he had stalls for all kinds of cattle and sheep folds. So he's got plenty of resources for feeding his people. Verse 29, he likewise provided cities for himself and flocks and herds in abundance, for God had given him very great possessions. So it's God that's blessing him. The next line we'd already talked about, this happening during a little crisis point. It says, this same Hezekiah closed the upper outlet of the waters of Gihon, that is to keep them from spilling out into the valley of the Kidron, where they could be used by the enemies of the city, specifically the Assyrians. And he directed them down to the west side of the city of David. That is, he directed them underground till they arrived at the pool of Siloam. And if you go to Israel today, you can have a tour of the archaeological remains of the Pool of Siloam, and you can even make the choice to pay a little extra and walk through the tunnel of Hezekiah's time from the Gihon Spring right down to the Pool of Siloam. An amazing engineering feat. And then finally, the last part of verse number 30, and Hezekiah prospered in all his works. So he is a good and godly man, and he's trying his best to help the people be good and godly. And because of that, he engaged in something that we're going to look at next, and that is adding more Proverbs to the book of Proverbs. So I want you to open your book of Proverbs to chapter number 25. I told you when we wrapped up with chapter 24, back in the study of the kingdom of Solomon, that we would come back to this at a later date with a later king. And so we've now arrived at that time. Chapter 25, verse 1 says, these also are Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, copied. So Hezekiah is devoted to bringing the nation back to its high point of devotion to God. And that would have been the best days of Solomon, his early years with the climax of the building of the temple and the writing and release of the book of Proverbs, which is just a collection of little short sayings encouraging people to think about things God's way. So now that Hezekiah is on the throne and he's moving his people toward God's heart, he decides apparently to re-release the book of Proverbs to make them readily available to the people of Israel, people of Judah specifically. And he sends his guys out to find all the other Proverbs that might still be hiding around in different places. Perhaps they found some when they were clearing out the temple. And to include that in this new edition of the book of Proverbs. Because you know that the goal of the book of Proverbs is this: the fear of he who is the beginning of wisdom. When we show respect and honor to God, it puts us on the right path to understand how he wants us to live in this world. So as we come back to this book tomorrow, and we will camp out here for a few days, I want you to be open to the idea that in these Proverbs, you will find things to help you live your life better for God. They are short and designed to be memorized so that we can have them readily available when we come to the problems of life. So get yourself a little notepad again and be ready to mark off some of these Proverbs that you want to add to your memorization procedures so that the next time temptation comes your way, you can do as David said, "I have hidden your word in my heart that I might not sin against you, God." Have a blessed day. See you tomorrow.